Good morning, everybody. Please be seated. Our first case this morning is case number 67240, Kravitz versus State. Mr. Orem for the appellate, Mr. McDonald for the respondent. Mr. Orem, you want to save some time on rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, 5 minutes.
Okay, I'll try to keep it on the clock.
If I may proceed, may I please court, my name is Christopher Orem. I'm attorney for Mr. Kravitz. This case is particularly complex. It's complex in the amount of facts that need to be analyzed to determine the issues that have been raised. But essentially what I want to do is just show you what the scientific evidence is and then explain to you that that would never result in a murder conviction. And then you look at all the other evidence and you see why they convicted Mr. Kravitz of murder. And that renders this as a completely unfair trial. Here are the facts. Undisputed facts. I don't think anything I'm about to say is really disputed. This lady is taken, the alleged victim, is taken to the hospital. When she's admitted into the hospital, they say at least four nurses, no signs of abuse. Nothing. She has no injuries on her. Nothing. They find that she has a skull fracture. Skull fracture, after a while, is resolving. She's taken to a rehabilitation center, and just under a month later, she dies of a heart attack. She'd had heart disease for many years. State's expert, medical examiner, comes in and says, well, it's undetermined the cause of death, but I saw no signs of external injuries, just a tiny little bruise that looked like it came from the inside of the head out. That was it. So she finds it's undetermined. This defense expert who's hired, who used to be a medical examiner in Clark County, says it's accident. She actually quotes, I think I'm saying it correctly, contra coup, which shows that this is from a fall. State's medical examiner says, yes, this could be from a fall. It could be from a fall on a flat surface. Defense expert says, it is from a fall. That's how she's died. Well, that's not how she died. She died of a heart attack, but this is what caused the injury. Does this unfortunate lady have a history of falls? Absolutely, the state admits, and they presented evidence that she had a history of falls throughout her life. One fall was so bad, it caused her to have positional vertigo. Additionally, the state in their brief points out that during one of her falls, the defendant had been incarcerated. So we can't put the falls on the defendant. She had a history of falling throughout her life. She fell, got injured, it was resolving, she died of a heart attack a month later. How do we know that the state believes that? Because the state had, for the entire trial, presented evidence that on the 24th of November, she must have been attacked by the defendant. However, having heard all of the expert testimony in rebuttal closing argument, the prosecutor makes the following statement. Maybe she did fall on the 24th. Not outside the realm of possibilities that she had already been injured by him on the 23rd and did truly fall on the 24th. She got injured on the 23rd, maybe even earlier. That's what Dr. Duke's testimony is. In the opening brief, I also cited to what the prosecutor said right before that. What makes sense in this case is, yes, the medical experts agree that, yes, this could have been a fall. But look again at all the medical records about her falls, because who knows that she has a history of falls? This guy sitting right over here. This is an accident. That's the state of the evidence. Why would a jury convict him of murder? That is obvious, because of the character assassination. Once you read this trial and take away the science and look at what was presented about Mr. Kravitz, I would suggest that they would have convicted Mr. Kravitz of anything, including his own father's murder, but his own father's death. And here's what I mean. They presented numerous bad acts. One of the bad acts was they had requested permission of the court to present, and it was granted. The other bad acts, they just put it into evidence as they wished. And let's look at these acts, because these acts...
Mr. Orem, as to a lot of these acts, was there any objection to them?
No, there was no objection. With regard to there was the 1999 beating of the victim by the defendant. He was accused and convicted of handcuffing his mother to a chair and beating her with a two-handed. That alone, that was objected to. There was motions filed under a Petrocelli hearing, and the judge ruled that that would be admissible. as I saw it, once you read that incident, it would make you so agitated at the defendant, just so agitated. What person handcuffed his mother and beat her with a 2x4? Well, we know the man who must have done this. And that was a real problem, so that was objected to. But then we look at the other facts. Did you know the defendant lost custody of his child? It had to be adopted out to another person. The defendant made people at the hospital, they felt uneasy in general. The detective said he looked through the county assessor's office and he learned that the poor lady was being, there was financial exploitation of the woman. All hearsay, but sweeping conclusion. They put on a trust attorney who said he received a letter. He wasn't quite sure about it, but he thought the defendant was threatening him. He also said that when Ms. Kravitz would call and talk to him, that it really wasn't her words. It must be the defendant behind all of that. By the end of this, and with one more fact, they continuously, with innuendo, presented that Mr. Kravitz's father died of a head injury in 1997. And why they said that was relevant and important and not a bad act is because he would have known, Mr. Kravitz should have known about head injuries and how dangerous they are. When I take a look at that and looked at all the bad acts, I realized that this was absolute propensity evidence. So in the end, when the prosecution admits that they cannot establish, because they were saying on the 24th, he attacked her, and at the very end, they abandoned that position, they retreat from it. So if we look at the science versus the propensity evidence, what do we really have? The science is, according to the prosecutor, something happened before the 24th. Don't know what.
But wouldn't this, like this abuse of his mother, it happened years before, wouldn't under 48045 be part of a common scheme or plan that that would make it admissible? A lot of the stuff had happened.
What I would argue is these court's decisions in, I cited to Beck and Walker, that the dissimilarity in the bad act from 1999, yes, it's very disturbing. I agree with that. And I think that's what got him convicted. But if you think of being handcuffed, an elderly lady being handcuffed or trying to beat with a 2x4, what's it going to leave? We know what it's going to leave. Just what Dr. Worrell said. She said it's going to leave bruises on the person. With all the elder abuse cases she'd seen, she'd always seen bruises. There's no bruises. So look at the dissimilarity. Justice Gibbons, if the state's argument is he handcuffed her again to a chair and beat her with a 2x4, where's the evidence of it? In the end, we don't know what he did. And that's what's so disturbing here is the prosecution is saying...
Well, I'm sure at the end the jury instructions limited the use of the bad acts, though, didn't they? The jury was instructed what they could use the bad acts for.
Under a Tavares instruction?
Yeah.
Yes, that may be true, but it just seemed uncontroverted. The scientists, the doctors, said there's no evidence. They didn't have homicide. How did the jurors look at the medical evidence? They'd be beyond a reasonable doubt. This is homicide.
Did the judge instruct the jury after the evidence of the beating of the mother?
I believe so.
What about after the lost custody of child?
No.
What about after the financial exploitation?
I don't believe so.
What about the defendant threatened the trust attorney?
I believe so.
What about made people at the hospital feel uneasy?
I don't believe so.
Was there any objection on my counsel?
No.
Well, I mean, again, under Tavares, it could have been strategic that the defense attorney didn't want the simultaneous instruction, you know, like that. I mean, for highlight reasons, it would highlight those offenses.
It's possible, but see,
did the judge have the attorneys approach the bench and say, would you like me to give the instruction like I did on beating his mother and handcuffing her?
I can't, from reading the trial transcript that long ago, I do not remember that independently, but the state was not putting that in. They were just, mostly, if you see on appeal, they're arguing these are not bad acts. They are bad acts. It's terrible what happened. But I just think that, do we know how she died other than it was an accident? What evidence is there? When the prosecutor says something happened beforehand, how can they retreat from that? What happened? Why? If she had a history of falls and she's fallen again, just like the medical examiners admit, and now she's died a month later from heart attack, what proof is there he's done anything wrong to her? And that's the problem. The proof that he's done something wrong to her is you hear those bad acts and you hate his guts. And that's exactly what 48.045 is designed to avoid. The cases that I cited talk about we don't want propensity evidence so strong that you convict the defendant of anything. That the defendant's father had died in 1997 of a head injury? I would suggest that from reading that trial transcript, that jury thought, I bet he did. I bet he did. But in the end, nobody in this courtroom can answer what he did and what day he did anything. And for the state to say, yeah, maybe it was a fall. So if it's a fall, as I look at this logically, let me show you how the state's argument is naturally would be seen by the jury. Something happened by a guy we don't like. I could just finish this. Something happened to her by this man we can't stand. We don't know what. We don't know when. She must have been hurt. Maybe she's punched in the stomach. Maybe she was slapped. She felt dizzy for days. She walked around, and then she had a fall. She had a fall. He got her medical attention. She went into the hospital, accused her dead husband of doing something. She was resolving, and a month later she died of a heart attack. How is that murder? Now, what kind of supposition and speculation is that? With that, I would request the last one.
You have 4 minutes, 25 seconds left. Mr. McDonald, for the state of Nevada.
Thank you. Good morning. May it please the court, Ryan McDonald for the state. Pardon me. I don't want to go into belaboring the facts too much because I think they're very well briefed in our answering brief as far as the entire context, the entire circumstantial context of the crime in this matter. But as to Mr. Oram talking about the medical evidence, there was an injury to her head, and it did not, the place that the injury happened did not match up with where the defendant said she found her mother. Now, of course, the defendant said he found his mother in one place to one person and in another place to another person. So that puts the medical evidence into context. And the neurosurgeon testified that the injury to the brain, based on the amount of edema swelling in the brain, happened at least 48 hours, if not a week, before. The defendant says the fall happened on the 24th.
Mr. McDonald, my concern on this, to follow up on Mr. Oram's argument, is was there sufficient evidence beyond a reasonable doubt for a trier of fact to conclude that this was a homicide? And if there, that conclusion was made, so tell us why you believe it was beyond a reasonable doubt, the evidence that was presented.
I think a lot of the evidence that we have is based on the defendant's actions leading up to the incident and immediately following the incident. The way that he behaved shows, in essence, a planning mind before and a guilty mind after. So, for instance, the multiple attempts to have him named as the trustee of the trust and have what we called in our briefing the wrongful act provision removed from the trust. The letter that he sent to her physician saying, I think my mom is going to accuse me of something. I'm really worried about that. The fact that the injury, according to the state's medical testimony, did not happen in the time that he said it did. That he told Matt Copas that the injury happened at the Primrose address, but that address was carpeted, so he changed his story later and said, oh, it happened at the other address, the one where I live, because that happens to be tiled. The detective said, well, how did you find her? And he found her laying on her left side, except the injuries don't match up with a fall to the head on the left side. So there's an entire context to
it. It sounds to me like we had a case of Brookie West versus State, where she was in a mother, unfortunately, some mother was put in a bath by her daughter, and they couldn't tell the cause of death. And I think we concluded in that case the circumstantial evidence could be considered as part of the determination.
Absolutely.
Inside. Is that the type of argument you're making?
Correct.
Here?
At the end of the day, this is an abuse case. Mm-hmm. It's an abuse case, so it will be a circumstantial case. Mm-hmm. And it's an abuse case, so you will have other bad act motions. Fortunately, in this case, we had pretrial litigation, which I always like to see motions in limine to try to get certain statements and bad acts in. Did you? Okay.
No.
So we filed a motion to admit 6 different bad acts. The district court held a Petrocelli hearing and made a very judicious decision and denied 5 out of the 6. So only the event where she was chained up in the wheelchair came in.
What about the father dying of a head injury? What's that have to do with this case?
So I will let the briefs speak for themselves, but I don't remember that being raised as an issue on appeal as one of the challenged non-objected to bad acts.
Okay.
And in fact, the prosecutor specifically said that we're only telling you this because, not because he did it, but because we want to, again, create the circumstantial context. He did not report this for a day and a half, according to him, even taking his story about the fall. He just kind of tried to give her soup and put her on the couch and just kind of let her sit there, except if his father had died of a head injury, then he would have known that this requires serious medical attention. That if your 88-year-old mother falls and it looks serious and she looks disoriented, you need to seek medical attention.
It just sounds to me like it's hard to believe that's more probative than prejudicial, you know, but of course that was the judge's call and hurt the case.
Right, and you can, and so what I did is I kind of contrasted with his decision. So his wife, the other bad act in 1999 where she gets restrained and beaten happened because earlier he had broke his wife's jaw and told both of them not to seek medical attention for her. She eventually does, and this is her punishment. So both of those were presented as possible bad acts, and the judge said, no, as to the wife, that is more prejudicial than probative. But as to this victim, because what we have here is not just elder abuse. You know, that could happen in a nursing home or something else. What we have here is a domestic violence situation. So we recognize in the cases that we cited, including most recently in the Reimer case, that when you have a domestic violence situation that in the end ends up with a murder or some other kind of injury, there's a course of conduct there. And that course of conduct goes to, in the ultimate event, the case at bar, when the defendant is claiming it's an accident, which he did here, that we have this case that says it can be more probative than prejudicial if it goes to absence of mistake or accident. And that's what that's the decision that the judge made after having the Petrocelli hearing, after listening to the testimony.
The other question I had on the bad acts part of this, and I think you've explained how the judge allowed some and didn't allow others, was the Linda Fields case where we had in Elko where we concluded that the state spent an enormous amount of time in their case in chief proving bad acts and little time on the facts of particular charges against Linda Fields, so we reversed that conviction. Can you give me an idea on the time spent and how the state presented this case in proportion to the bad acts versus other evidence?
Well, the district court only admitted the one bad act. So that was admitted through the testimony of Ms. Leonard. So that was the amount of time that we spent on that. It's not, we didn't get up in closing and kind of say, look at this event. Very little time was spent on that arguing, in fact. The other bad acts that are presented in the brief, most of them aren't even acts, okay? People felt bad around him. The detective had concerns. That's not an act, the detective having concerns that maybe there's shenanigans going on with property transfers. The hospital personnel were scared. And the letter. Well, the letter is, I don't even know what to make of the letter to the trust attorney, because it says something like, you know, you need to shape up or I'm going to do something that really curls your toes, LOL. The attorney said, seems weird, basically is what he said. Could be a bad joke. So the letter, I think, is the only one that you could even characterize as an act, much less a bad act.
Okay.
Any particular response to Mr. Arnold's position as to the ultimate death should not be attributed to the fall, from the medical information put in the record?
I think what was omitted in that discussion is that because she had swelling in her brain, she could not safely receive administration of drugs and intervention that could have helped the cardiac situation. So that's where you get into the independent intervening event, because she's in the hospital because of this brain injury. She may have an underlying cardiac condition, but she developed pneumonia, and she was obviously in a weakened state. And what got the ball rolling was the injury to the brain.
Anything further?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Roman, rebuttal, please.
Yes. First of all, there are things said that are inaccurate in the state's argument right now. First of all, the state argues, you see, she fell, he didn't get her help. That's what he just said. I cite in the record, and the state actually presented evidence, that it was the day before Thanksgiving, and he called Dr. Christian Stormer's office and said, I need to get my mother into the doctor's office. They told him, you cannot, because of Thanksgiving, bring her in on Monday. He then does wait, and then calls 911 some 36 hours later. So you see the problem, what they presented, that she's just laying there and he's doing nothing. It's not accurate. Then they are so confident this is elder abuse, yet there's no injuries on her. And the medical examiner for the defense and the state admitted there's no injuries on her. No, obviously the skull fracture, but no physical external injuries. The state argues, well, it was on the left side of her head. She was conscious. Anybody who's seen somebody hurt can think that they could roll around. It just seems odd to me. You would think somebody fall and then they're frozen in time. And he said he was outside by the pool. When he came in, he'd seen her fall. She'd fallen at a post office. She'd had serious falls, and they were all noted by the state. The prosecutor talks about the letter to the trust attorney and she doesn't know what to make of it. That's why I objected to it. If you don't know what to make of it, why are you presenting that a member of the bar felt threatened? What's the relevance of it? These are bad acts. Additionally, it was sort of implied up here that, hey, the district court judge looked at all the bad acts and made a determination. As I point out in the brief, that happened one time on the 1999 beating of the mother. All the rest of these just came in at the pleasure of the state of Nevada. They just
why would it be harmless, though, considering the evidence that Mr. McDonald just reviewed with us?
Your Honor, it isn't harmless, because I'm missing what the evidence is that makes her guilty, makes this a homicide. How is this not a fall, Justice Chair? How is it not a fall? Everybody admitted it was a fall. The state doesn't have an expert who wouldn't say it couldn't be from a fall. So what evidence of homicide? The only evidence of homicide is he's a really bad guy. He's a really obnoxious here, a person you really want to hate, a person you really want to, you know, punish for all the things he's done. But there's no evidence at all that he had harmed her, and even the prosecutor retreated from that right in rebuttal. Okay, maybe we've been presented.
Well, what about the circumstantial evidence that Mr. McDonald cited to, in addition to the medical testimony, about, you know, the location of the injury, but the other circumstances it was irrelevant, though, to consider whether or not there was a homicide.
Yes, and I think circumstantial evidence can be very good. So what is the circumstantial evidence that they present? You heard it up here right now. He didn't call for medical attention. I just disproved that. A letter to a trust attorney that she was calling the trust attorney saying, I think I need to make changes. The trust attorney is then permitted to say, I don't think that was really her. That's him putting undue influence on her. She had Alzheimer's. Right now I heard the prosecutor say, well, he was concerned that maybe she was going to falsely accuse him. In the hospital, she told hospital workers that her husband, who was dead, had beaten her to hell without an injury on her and a dead husband. So what is the circumstantial evidence? There is none. The circumstantial evidence, really, in sum, if you said to me, find him guilty, I'm like, he's a bad guy.
He's a, look at all these senior citizens.
I thought the changing of the trust and all that, that could be financial motivation for her death, you know, like that he was trying to facilitate her death to get his hands on her money. That could be considered by the jury, couldn't it?
Yes, and as I pointed out in the briefs numerous times, it's just inadmissible hearsay. But I'll accept, let's utilize that hearsay. If we do, what was the evidence? Here was the mother, the alleged victim calling, saying, I need some help. Isn't it common for a parent to ask the person who's her caretaker, he's her caretaker, to assist and make sure that her financial situation is properly taken care of? There's nothing different here.
Well, didn't he change that he wanted to make some changes there that would benefit him? I mean, there was evidence that there was requests to make changes in the trust, which would go to his benefit financially then.
But it was her caretaker. You can see how a parent would want to assist the child who's taking care of her, and these were often her requests. And the state then presents it, well, it must be undue influence. Maybe it was just her request. He's taking care of her.
But it's up to the jury. That argument, I assume, was made to the jury that that's what it was, and the jury can either accept that or not accept it.
Yes, but I would suggest, Justice Gibbons, that they did this because they were so agitated. If you look at the bad acts, his character, it was a character assassination. I would suggest a complete review of this case would lead a scientist to what the doctors and experts came up with. We can't say this is homicide. Only the jury was able to. I see my time is up.
Okay. Thank you. Well, thank both you, skilled prosecutor, skilled defense attorney. Good arguments, good briefs. This matter will get submitted. Thank you very much, both of you. Nice job.